I carried a lot of shame and guilt about how I felt, and I blamed myself a lot. I felt unworthy and all those things. And mindfulness was able to help me to kind of step away from that, from feeling that I was responsible for all of that. So I carried all that stuff on my shoulders all my life, thinking that I was bad and unfixable and a wrong person and all that stuff because of circumstances that were outside of my control.
Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleason and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope, and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations, and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift. Welcome back to this episode of Shapes of Grief. I'm joined today by Alan Creedon, author from West Yorkshire. Alan has written a book called The Search for Still Waters. And I'm intrigued to speak with Alan today about the journey that he made and the content of his book, what brought him to this place. Alan, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you, Liz. Good to be here chatting.
When I read your email, in fact, I might just read it out for the listeners, Alan, if that's okay.
Sure.
There was no way I was going to pass up this opportunity to chat with you. So Alan wrote to me and it says, a few years ago, I made a journey in memory of my sister who had severe cerebral palsy. I struggled for years with depression until I decided to make the journey. So I walked from Manchester, where I lived at the time, to Dingle in Ireland, where I grew up. This 400-mile walk took 29 days and also involved crossing the Irish Sea by kayak, an occasionally grueling 22-hour journey across 60 miles of water. I had never, ever attempted anything like that before. I barely knew how to swim, had never been in a kayak, and wasn't even that into walking. I just knew I had to shift what was inside me, and the only way to begin doing that was by challenging myself, not giving into fear and anxiety as I always had. The journey itself helped me to begin coming to terms with what I then saw as my long-held grief, which resulted in depression and other mental health issues. And I began to accept those disowned parts of myself. Alan, that's some introduction. Can we go back to your beloved sister and start there?
Yeah, sure. Aoife was, I guess, about 15 months younger than me. So, and she was born, it was due to a birth complication. Actually, she ended up with severe cerebral palsy. I guess for a while it was just normal until I kind of start to learn a bit more about it. She also went into a home when she was 18 months, so very young. And I think it was a very difficult decision for my parents to make, but it was at the time that was the sort of way things were, I think, in rural Ireland. And, I guess they already had a couple of kids, and caring for her was more than they could do, because she had pneumonia, I think, somewhere between 5 and 8 times in her first year, and she was on the edge a lot. So I guess there was a, Aoife from my own younger memories, a lot of the memories were going to see her in the home she was in. And when she came to visit us, then just kind of being with her in the only way you could, really, which is kind of lying on the floor or something like that, or, you know, feeding her. She was in a home until she was about five, I think. And then she went to one that was a bit closer. But my memories of that first place were of a very kind of frightening, you know, kind of slightly traumatic memory. So I kind of really felt like it was a kind of bad place in a way. Even though the people there were working, they were, you know, trying to care for all these children, it still felt scary for me. And I guess as a child in those days, there wasn't that much explanation about what was going on. And so I was kind of left to my own devices, really, about how I dealt with it. And that was, I guess that was the beginning of my relationship with my sister in so many ways.
And I guess it's the context, like you say, is so important. I assume this was 1970s rural Ireland.
Yeah, she was born in 77.
Yeah. Okay. So just this, the lack of talking about anything. And it was those days where the parish priest probably would have made recommendations and nobody would have gone against those recommendations.
Well, who knows? It could well have been, you know, yeah.
Yeah. But what I'm hearing is Aoife was very compromised and ill, and it was a difficult decision for your parents. But somehow, I don't want to put words on the story, they felt that this was the right thing to do or the only thing to do.
They were advised. And I think it was by actually medical professionals. They were advised for the best sort of care she could have would be where she had probably closer connection to medical services. I think that was a big part of it.
Okay. And in the absence of somebody telling you what was going on or why Aoife was there, what did you make up? What was the narrative you told yourself?
Yeah, well, this is so as the years went by, I guess I felt sad for my sister because I had two other sisters, a younger sister born a few years later and an older sister. And they were, you know, quote, normal. And I was, quote, normal, and Aoife wasn't. And I think accepting her condition was difficult. And I ended up deciding as a little child that she wasn't who she was meant to be. That really, you know, it was a tragedy in a sense. Her life was a tragedy because this last minute kind of complication meant that her potential was snatched away, you know, right at the last second. It was just a disaster in a sense. And I suppose I took that to heart in many ways. And I guess the thing that I then took from that somehow logically in my own mind was that I also wasn't who I was meant to be. And that was a weird one because I guess it was weird about my sister anyway. You know, it didn't feel weird. That was just like how I thought about her. She wasn't who she was meant to be. It's sad. You know, this is sad. This is a sad situation. And it was difficult to talk about, to share, to kind of say anything really about it. But it kind of, in a way, you can see the sort of logic of how maybe I made that leap for myself too. And I felt, you know, I began to feel really out of kilter with society a bit, with my friends, socializing, and a great many people in my life, really.
So how did that manifest then for you, Alan, growing up? Being in this house, feeling like I'm not who I'm meant to be. Her potential was snatched from her. Mm. And somehow the ripple of this made you feel that you were all had something snatched from you. I mean, your sister was snatched from you in a way.
Yeah, for sure. I think for me, it was, I guess I, you know, I'm a sensitive person and I was a very sensitive little boy. And I found that I easily reacted to teasing and, you know, of which there was quite a bit, which is fairly normal in Irish families anyway, I think. And so But for me, I just took so many things to heart, you know. And I suppose that those are, in a way, the things that kind of started me thinking that I wasn't that, you know, oh, it's what people are saying, you know, people who are critical or whatever, even if they were joking, it's still, I still kind of thought, oh no, maybe I am a bit wrong, a bit of a wrong one. And, you know, I just kind of kept telling myself this story in the sense that I wasn't right, you know, I wasn't who I should be, and I didn't feel confident, and, you know, I never did well at school, really. I had trouble with keeping friends, you know, didn't have girlfriends really in school, and I really felt like an outsider. I felt like I wasn't accepted. And but, you know, that perhaps looked very differently from other people's perspective. You know, it's possible that I was quite a defensive, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, I probably was quite defensive, and it's likely I had a wall, you know, between myself, because I didn't want to get hurt by people. So I guess I built up defenses. I isolated myself in so many ways.
Hi, everyone. Excuse this brief interruption. It's Liz here, and I wanted to tell you about my grief training program. If you are interested in becoming grief literate or grief trained, I've designed a comprehensive online program which you can do at your own pace in your own time. It's been designed primarily for healthcare providers, but we all have a right to grief training and education. So if you're interested, then it's for you too. Sign up today at shapesofgrief.com. Now, back to the podcast.
I think when we're vulnerable, we do that, don't we? We retract, our comfort zone becomes very small. And, you know, to lose your sister from the family home in that way would be enough to make anybody recoil and retract and shrink. And particularly then, you know, in the absence of explanation or anybody, sort of a family discussion happening or explanations being provided as to what was going on. And one can only imagine, and, you know, I'm Irish, I grew up in a big family in the 70s in Ireland. I know that sort of atmosphere of what the hell is actually going on here, because things were unsayable, like so much was unsayable. And it was these, you know, the power of the Catholic Church, and everything that was in any way emotional in my house anyway, was an unspoken undercurrent. You know, it's a very difficult situation to grow up in. So you brought that out into the world, and you know, had, as you say, you had this wall around you. And, you know, in that email you sent me, Alan, you said long-held depression. Were your teens and early adult years difficult?
Yeah, they were, really. I mean, you know, as teenage years, I was... I would say I was depressed probably from the age of, I don't know, young, probably 10, 11, maybe. And yeah, I just felt disconnected, felt very sensitive. And I think as soon as I hit maybe 13, 14, I started getting bullied a bit in school. And that sort of drove me further into myself. And, you know, school grades started going downhill. And, you know, I guess I isolated myself even more. And, you know, I still had the odd friend, but I just found it hard to trust, you know, I really found it hard to trust people. And I was better off on my own. And I did spend a lot of time on my own, and not really, you know, I had my Walkman and I used to go on long walks or go on my bike. And, you know, I spent a lot of time on my own, but I also spent a lot of time on my uncle's farm, which was next door to us. And that was actually a saving grace for me, to be able to, you know, just kind of get lost in work a bit, actually. Physical work kind of saved me in so many ways, because I was able to put my whole being into it, you know, distract myself in many ways, and also feel like I was doing something productive. So in a way, I kind of, you know, I was grounded. I was able to be grounded by stuff like that. And I'm very grateful for my dad and my uncle, really, for just kind of showing me that, you know, just off you go. It didn't work, didn't feel like, you know, oppressive or anything. It felt liberating in some way.
I get that. It's like putting the energy or the attention into a shovel rather than ruminating.
Absolutely.
You know, coming into the body rather than the mind. So, you know, this journey, where did that all come from, and what happened, Aoife? What, fill us
in. Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, so I left home when I was 19, went over to England. I just went for a summer, but I ended up staying. I just didn't want to go back home, you know. I felt very disconnected from Ireland. But it really, you know, and I saw it as that for a long time. But, you know, now I see now that it wasn't Ireland necessarily I was disconnected from. It was actually myself, you know. But I was blaming the whole of my life, you know, including Ireland in a sense. And I guess, I came to England and just forgot about my past, tried to forget about things. I still went home regularly, but, you know, every time I went to visit Aoife, it was difficult, you know, really difficult. And I still think that's just a trauma response from those early years of going to visit her when it felt scary, and that stuck, you know. And so
could
going
you tell
to
us what it was like as an adult going to visit Aoife?
I mean, you know, it was fine once I got there, but it was more the kind of anticipation of going to see Aoife, because it brought up those feelings. There was like a great deal of resistance and tussle and emotional turmoil around, like, oh God, no, oh, it feels too hard, you know, it just feels too difficult. And then when I get there, it'll be fine, you know, and I take her out for a walk, and, you know, I'd kind of connect with her as Aoife. She was always in a wheelchair or lying down because she couldn't walk. And so I just take her out for a walk, and, you know, I'd sing to her and I'd connect, you know, I really would make that effort, and it felt right. However, outside of those moments of being with her, it was just too difficult still, you know, it hadn't resolved itself in a sense. And I suppose, so then she became ill in 2010, I think, or early 2011. And then she died in September 2011, and that was a weird and interesting time, because, you know, as a family, we all kind of grieved for her and also let something go at the same time. And, you know, I can only speak for myself here, I'm not going to try and speak for my family at all, but, you know, for me, there was like a letting go when she died. There was a kind of a great sadness, but also relief is probably the wrong word. But, you know, because of there had been so much long held tension and pain because of my relationship with Aoife's life, there was a relief, you know.
Mm. Well, you were finally able to grieve what had probably been an ambiguous loss until then. You know, you grieved at some level your sister leaving the family home, but yet she wasn't dead. So nobody has died. There isn't a hearse, as Pauline Boss would say. She coined this term, ambiguous loss.
Right.
But yet there's a tremendous loss in losing your sister from the family home in that way. So it was to take 34 years.
Yeah, you know, my maths now is terrible, but yeah, something like that. And yeah, and then so when she died, I guess the you know, the funeral, it was lovely, you know, it was beautiful, and we all got to say a few words, and I really enjoyed that. And I remember saying, you know, I don't remember the exact words I said at her the funeral, but it was something like, Aoife touched people's lives in a deep way. And, you know, even though part of me didn't really believe that, I kind of knew that for myself too. So I'll kind of come back to that in a minute, because it's kind of relevant really to what happened after that. Because when I went back to my life in the UK, you know, I'm married, and my wife got pregnant, actually, 3 months later, we'd been trying for years, and it seemed like a bit of a whoa, somehow a bit of a coincidence, but we've been trying for years to have a baby, and we kept thinking about Aoife, and anyway, I just got stuck back into work like I always did, and you know, I worked hard, and certain, yeah, a few things happened that made me really think. And I realized that about 3 years after Aoife had died, that I was just forgetting about her. I didn't feel like I was grieving. You know, I've just felt like I was putting it behind me. And so on some deep level, I knew that wasn't right. Or not that it wasn't right, but I knew there was something I had to explore.
And did you have depression at this stage, Alan?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was always living with that. I always lived with, you know, like I said, from when I was a child, the trust issues. I could never keep friends very well, because I always became sort of paranoid and afraid that I couldn't trust them. And I kind of would make up stories about people, you know, judging people all the time, finding it really difficult to start projects, you know, to start and do create something that I wanted to do, because I felt like I was no good at anything. And you know, so I one thing I knew I was good at was working. Like, you know, from when I was a kid, I just worked. So I just worked and worked and worked, and but at the same time, I knew I had a creative side to me. You know, I knew that I had other things to offer, should we say, and I felt, you know, I felt I had a longing to reach those parts of myself, and so I guess I was kind of distracting myself at work. I drank a lot, took drugs. You know, I was kind of in that self-medicating through alcohol kind of thing, and that was just normal life. You know. And then I guess when my daughter was born in 2012, that was a shift for me, and it held up a big mirror to me, and I saw that, you know, drinking was a problem, not an alcoholism, but it was just a problem for me, you know. And actually I couldn't continue it because of her sleeping patterns, and so I had to stop drinking almost completely, which, you know, I didn't enjoy because I didn't see people as much, but at the same time, I guess it gave space for me to reflect a bit more, be a bit more sober and make some decisions. And I also got a job as a grower, growing organic food. That's the kind of sector I worked in for a long time. And by being with the land again, I think I some changes started to happen within me, and I finally came around to the idea that I could do this journey. It sort of, it sort of started to come into my head, and I kind of thought, you know, what a crazy idea that is. It's a crazy idea. I can never do it. And so I was quite lucky to have access to a life coach. Because my wife is a coach, but she had a friend who would basically coach me for whatever I could afford at the time. And I honestly, it was such a gift. And so she helped me to make that choice, because the decision was the hard bit in so many ways. It's like, how do I make a leap from feeling like I'm useless and not doing anything with my life to actually taking a massive step outside my comfort zone and doing this big journey? And yeah, that took so much courage in a way. I needed to have my hand held to make that choice, you know, because it was such a big choice.
It's really interesting. You were saying your grief, you were trying to put it behind you, and you seemed to have difficulty accessing your grief or accessing the expression of it.
Yeah.
So in a way, in the absence of being able to make that internal journey with your grief, you created a literal journey, something very tangible.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that was it. And again, this idea of embodiment, you know, I sort of embodied my grief in so many ways. And, you know, I guess the idea of the journey, I didn't know this at the time, but in a sense, the idea of the journey was to embody my grief. It was to sort of reach a bit deeper into my physical being, into myself, than I ever had. And again, I didn't know that this was what I was doing when I took on the walk. I knew I wanted to explore how I felt about my sister, and I raised money for charity as well. You know, I kind of did the things that felt like would be useful, but I was also on this deep inner journey as well. Yeah.
So why the walk? Where did that come from? And back to Dingle, which is on the, for anyone listening who doesn't know, it's in the very west of Ireland, one of the furthest tips, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's where I grew up. So I walked, and at the time I was living in Manchester. So I just kind of thought, okay, the easiest way for me to do this walk is just to walk home, basically. So I got the inspiration for the walk I went to Scotland one time to went to the Outer Hebrides, to this tiny little sort of museum in Harris, and there's a little tiny museum and dedicated to William MacGillivray, who was a ornithologist and bird artist. And there was a little book in this shop called A Walk to London, and I kind of like was intrigued, so I bought the book and I read it. And although it was written hundreds of years ago, and, you know, in some ways no relation whatsoever to my life, but it did. That was what sowed the seed. That's what made me think, oh, I could do, you know, I can do something like that. You know, I was never an outdoorsy person. I have a lot of friends who are outdoorsy, and they'll just go off on adventures, or, you know, do the Camino or things like that. I'd never even thought of anything like that, you know. And although I worked a lot outdoors physically, I never thought about doing that for, yeah, just going on that kind of long trek. So that was what helped me to make the decision. Door to door, I thought was a nice idea. Set off from Manchester, end up in Dingle. And then with the kayaking, I kind of decided I just wanted to, because I was doing that much of an adventure, I may as well like do something totally crazy and try and figure out a weird way to cross the Irish Sea. So I did a lot of asking around and posting on different forums and things. And eventually this guy, Mike, found me and said, hey, I might be able to take you across in a kayak, which we basically went in a double kayak, a two-person kayak. So I wasn't on my own, thankfully.
Yeah. There's such a longing for life, it sounds like. You know, it's just a longing to... Like, I can really relate to this at times where you want to throw yourself into the cold sea or do the Camino or get a tattoo or just do something radical to feel alive again. Would you resonate with that? I see you nodding your head, Alan.
100%, yeah.
What was the drive that threw you into walking 400 miles?
And the
60.
Yeah. Well, the drive was just... like plain and simple, I am so sick of feeling like this.
Yeah.
I am so sick of it. I know there's more for me. I know there is, you know. Even though I felt terrible and useless and, you know, all those things, I just was sick of it, sick to death of it. And yeah, I knew I had to do something big and something symbolic in order to show myself, I guess, number one, that I could do it and not fail, at least give it a good go. And number two, I don't know if there is a number two. No, just number one will do.
So it's like this part of you wanted to prove another part wrong. The part that says you're a failure, you're useless, you're good at nothing. There was another part of you that was like, no, there is something more and we're going to find it. You know?
Definitely. It was definitely a symbolic journey, you know, a spiritual quest even, you know.
So I'm really curious to know what the journey was like as someone who has done the Camino
Oh,
a
yeah.
couple of times. I did it in my 20s and then I did it just a few years ago with my daughter as well. I'd love to know what the walking was for you.
Sure, thanks. So yeah, well, I guess as you probably know, it's never probably what you're going to expect for a start. Well, for me, I like I said, I had no experience doing this kind of thing. So first of all, my backpack was way too heavy, and I got really bad blisters on the soles of my feet on day two, which I had to walk on all the way to Holyhead, which was 100 miles. And so I, because I already thought I was a failure anyway, I was sure like the walk was over on day three kind of thing. I just went through hell. I put myself through hell in the first week, and that was kind of my habit anyway, was to kind of give myself a really hard time about stuff. So there was nothing new there in a way. But what I did was I stuck with it. It was really difficult, incredibly painful, but I just stuck with it, and I made sure that I met with people I knew. So I kind of coincided my walk with friends along the way, and I stayed with people all along the way to Wales. And each person was like a, manna from heaven kind of thing. They were just there. They completely supported me and listened to my whinging. And I also made an effort to talk about Aoife because that was part of the journey. So I would talk about Aoife, and even if I didn't kind of get anything back or feel anything, I just thought, yes, this is part of it. I'm talking about Aoife. And and so for the first week or so, it was incredibly difficult, but also it was kind of, it felt like I was continuing, which was the main thing, and I felt support. Even though at times, I think for a long time I didn't allow support. I didn't allow people to kind of, I didn't, I felt, it felt like a weakness to, to be vulnerable or, to open myself in that way. But I just, yeah, like I said, I'd had enough, so I had, it was time for me to just fully open. And so yeah, I guess that first week was difficult, but getting to North Wales and Holyhead, once the pain started to ease a bit, I started to feel really buoyant and actually quite frightened once I was getting towards the Irish Sea.
Just to backtrack a little bit, Alan, you said it was time to fully open. What did that look like?
Well, I suppose, I've always been into exploring, wanting to explore my depths, I guess. And I don't know if you'd call it being spiritual or, I've always known there's kind of more there within myself kind of thing than is just represented in the world in front of me. And so, and that includes healing, and that includes, understanding myself more. And so I knew that on that journey to fully open up to my relationship with Aoife, and to work on the grief side of things, I guess, or to understand what my relationship was with her a bit more. I knew I had to open up to people more, and I knew that through sharing that I would get some insight, and I would be able to learn something new, about myself, about my relationship, and maybe about, yeah, and part of my journey as well was to kind of look at my depression and see if there was a way through that or any other opportunities that would come up, So I've my intention, I suppose, in this, in a way, was to be open. It was just to be open to what was there, what was, and who I met. And I wasn't kind of pushing any experience away. It was like if I met somebody randomly in the street, I was like, hi, what can I, what can we offer each other in this moment kind of thing,
I'm curious to know how your experience of the world changed as you presented yourself differently in the world. So as you unzipped and essentially offered yourself to authentically to whoever you would encounter, how did your life change, your experience?
Yeah, well, as the journey progressed, you know, I guess I got to North Wales, and sometimes I would meet people who were just completely didn't care what I was doing, you know, and that's fine. Yeah, and sometimes I would meet a random person who would be like, oh my God, you know, it's amazing what you're doing. Can I look after you in some way? And, you know, people might give me something or some money towards the fundraising, or want to give me a lift somewhere if I looked sort of a bit bedraggled and downtrodden, or, and, you know, I kind of kept getting these little lovely signs to keep going in a way, these sort of signposts, you could almost say. And I guess
like
once,
what? Sorry? Like what?
Well, just the kindnesses, you know, just that support. And I think like I started opening up to allowing myself to be supported and feeling a bit more worthy, you know, and that was that signpost, you know, keep going because it's worth it, you know, this journey is worth it. And I guess then when I did the kayaking part, that was just it was amazing and beautiful. And around halfway across a bit more, like a whale came up out of the sea.
Yeah.
And just for a moment, and, you know, I kind of thought of Aoife again, and I kind of, you know, I've just sort of felt, oh, this is powerful. You know, this journey is so powerful. And I had to dig so deep because we, you know, it became really difficult so many times, and especially going through the night, and you know, 22 hours was such a long time. And I think I'd never experienced that sort of endurance kind of test before. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things you couldn't, you know, yes, I had a phone, or even I had a satellite phone in case we have trouble, but I had a phone like we could bail out if we really had to. But really, there was only one direction we were going in, and that was Dunleary. And
just tell us briefly, who was this extraordinary person who accompanied you across the Irish Sea in his kayak?
Yeah, Mike Alexander, he's called, and he worked at a youth charity in the UK that does adventure with kids. I've forgotten the name right now, but they lent us a kayak for the journey. So he was an instructor. He was a five-star kayak instructor, so he really knew what he was doing. And he's also up for adventure and hadn't done the Irish Sea crossing before. It's not a thing people do very often, but it is a thing that people do that's a bit of quite a chunky undertaking, even for a kayaker, even for an experienced kayaker. So I think for him, there was like that adventure, a sense of adventure, but also he's got a big heart. I think he just saw that I had a kind of passion to do this. And we had a couple of goals beforehand. So we did have two goals, first two times in the kayak beforehand, and then we did the trek.
So he got you as far as Dunleary, and did you say goodbye there to Mike?
Yes, I did, yeah. Because when we got to Dunleary, the idea was that he'd go back in the ferry with the kayak. But of course, what I didn't realise is the ferry had stopped going from Dunleary 18 months before. So we were there stranded on the east pier of Dunleary, and we managed to scramble a van together and get him off to North Wall. But yeah, we did. We hugged, and it wasn't quite the, we wanted to go for a pint and everything, but it just didn't work out that way. But yeah, it was amazing. He dropped me off and was whisked off to North Wall. And I've seen him. I've only seen him once since, but it was quite an adventure. We were both totally wrecked after it.
Tell me about the backpack. You discovered it was too heavy sometime before you hit the coastline in England. What did you do with your backpack?
Yeah, well, I kept... So I stuck with everything I had for the first week, probably. And then I met my wife one day. She came to meet me on Anglesey. And I basically just ditched a good chunk of my stuff. So I think I reduced the weight by probably about 5 kilos or more. And because I think my bag was weighing probably, or I don't even know, but I'd say around 25 kilos.
It's just so symbolic, isn't it? The stuff.
The weight carry, thing. Yeah, for
the
sure.
The weight of stuff we carry that we really don't have to carry.
Yeah, I like that. And there was a further weight, ditching of weight further along as well, interestingly. Yeah.
So tell us about that and about your walk then from Dunedin to Fingal.
So then from Dublin, it kind of started to. So I had a day's rest in Dunleary, and then walked along, and that's when something started opening up. So I met with some family. I stayed with cousins, distantly related people I didn't really know, and I talk about it in the book as well. But I met with Anne, who's a cousin of mine, and she lost her husband when her kids were quite young, and her story was just astounding to me, and we both kind of opened up about our stories. And so, and you know, it was just timing, you know, and I felt so struck. I was open, you know, when I talk about being open, I felt really like I was becoming more open at that point. And so the stories were going in really deeply. And so, and then the next place I went was to a friend, Rita, and she'd lost a baby at a couple of months, was it 10 weeks or something like that. And again, her story of grief and how she dealt with it was completely astounding to me. And I just realized how many ways there were to look at grief in that moment and in those moments. And then even through where I was walking along the Grand Canal, there were everywhere there were death symbols. There were like crosses at the sides of the canal from people maybe who had, because there was a road there, people maybe who had drowned. And, you know, I was just seeing it everywhere. And I was surrounded by grief. And I just kind of immersed myself in it, or, you know, I was really feeling it for several days of the walk. So the people I met and the situation I was in where I was walking, it kind of started to open it up for me a bit and helped me to see that, you know, it probably very, very much was withheld grief that I'd had all my life in many ways, that, you know, perhaps even caused that depression, that idea of that there was something wrong, you know, with Aoife, or that she wasn't who she was meant to be. That's when my grief began, when I decided that she wasn't who she was meant to be. I grieved for the sister I never had.
And internally and silently, and yeah, on your own.
Yeah, exactly.
All the ways we're not meant to grieve.
Right.
You know, we're meant to grieve in community and to allow our bodies to express and wail and
for sure,
you know,
yeah,
make sense of it. And it's like you were really pushed down. Mm. That's where the word depression comes from, doesn't it? To depress something.
For sure. Yeah, I'd agree. And that was, you know, in a sense, I was doing the work there, you know, in a sense, because I didn't necessarily kind of go, and have a kind of enlightenment moment or anything, you know. But what was happening was stuff was happening and things were shifting inside me. And I knew that I had to be open, even if I wasn't feeling any different in those moments. I knew I had to be open to whatever was coming. And so I just kept that attitude of being open. And so for the rest of the walk, I, you know, met some amazing people, was really looked after, and had an amazing reception in Dingle, you know, when I got there. And so I guess in many ways, I would say that journey was in many ways the beginning of me opening up to grief. And I feel like I still am I'm still exploring it in so many ways. Which is fine. You know, I'm happy to explore it for the rest of my life, and it's because it's not kind of straightforward and it's not, I don't know. Yeah. So I guess it kind of opened me up to it, really. It kind of made me see that it was okay. You know, what I was going through was okay. And that actually I needed to heal. And although that journey was the beginning, really, for me. So, yeah.
So what I'm hearing is it brought you access to your grief. And what, you know, would you say it changed your depression as well? Grief is quite a vibrant, awake, alive emotion. It's very different to depression. They're two separate things. And I'm wondering, as you began to open up to grief, and I love that idea of you walking and hearing other people's grief stories along the way and giving you that sense of belonging in the world again. Mm. You know, grief is part of our common humanity. Mm. Did anything change with the depression?
Yeah, I think it started to, you know, it started to not feel as deeply rooted. Mm. And I kind of started to see, I kind of felt that because I had made that journey and made the effort to really push myself to really explore something deep, that I, in a sense, was changed. You know, I had the belief that I was changed, and I felt like there is no turning back now. Now I have to continue. And even though at the time when I did the journey, I was just like, you know, I was hoping for that, like, hallelujah, I've changed, you know, everything's great now. But you know, it wasn't like that for me. And, you know, and that was hard in itself. But, you know, what I saw was that I was at the beginning of exploring, of healing my depression and also exploring grief and other aspects of, I guess, my inner world from that journey.
Did you stay open, Alan?
I would say yes, I have stayed open. Yeah.
And how has that changed your relationships with your wife, your daughter, life, the world?
I think that over time, it has really helped. And I think for me, it's taken me quite a few years of working through stuff and, you know, using different techniques. I've done quite a lot of nature connection, as in like just sitting, being, because I find being in with the natural world is a very accepting environment to be in, to be with your own stuff. And I think, you know, how depression started showing up for me was just in a lot of confusion and anger and, you know, different things that were just a jumble and a mess and a fog. So actually targeting and working on stuff felt difficult. So to actually just sit in and try and be and learn to meditate and things like that felt like really important things. And also, you know, bits of therapy and once a body work even. And then once I started learning mindfulness, actually mindfulness meditation, that was like a clean in the glass moment for me and helped me to kind of let go of the, which actually didn't feel so deep, the anxiety, just the surface anxiety, which kind of covered so much of the possibility of my experience. It just kind of opened up and showed me that I had come a long way, actually, and that I could be open, more open. So
what was it about the mindfulness? Was it cultivating that inner witness that's looking at your experience as opposed to being the experience? Was that, you know, new for you at that time, or was there something else about mindfulness that made it such an effective tool for you?
I think it was seeing that I wasn't responsible for everything that happened to me in my life. You know, I carried a lot of shame and guilt about how I felt, and I blamed myself a lot. You know, I felt unworthy and all those things. And mindfulness was able to help me to kind of step away from that, from feeling that I was responsible for all of that. So I carried all that stuff on my shoulders all my life, thinking that I was bad and unfixable and a wrong person and all that stuff, because of circumstances that were outside of my control. And so a big part of mindfulness for me was seeing that I didn't need to hold on to that stuff, because actually the only thing that I can ever control or have any agency over is my own reaction and my own feelings about things. So I could never change a situation or even necessarily influence what's happening, or I can't see the future or what's coming, but I can be with how I am and see where I can, I guess, be more in my body and more centered and, yeah, confident and comfortable, I guess. Mm. And so I've worked on that a lot.
And Alan, what is your relationship with Aoife like today? Where do you find her? How do you talk with her? Who is she for you now?
I feel I'm still developing my relationship with my sister. And I think one of the biggest things for me around Aoife was the feeling that I couldn't ever have a relationship with her because she died. And also the feeling that I never really accepted her while she was alive. And so that's kind of big stuff in a way, you know? And I think that was the fuel that has made me practice acceptance in my own life. And so in a way, Aoife has influenced my entire direction in life, you could say, because I wholeheartedly, you know, we all have blind spots, right? But I wholeheartedly practice acceptance in as many situations as I can in my life now. And I think Aoife has so much to do with that, because I spent so much of my life not accepting her as a real person and not accepting myself. And so I'm kind of going the other way. I'm like an acceptance junkie. So I keep coming back to this thing with Aoife, which is she's still part of my life. She in some sense is in everything I'm doing now, because I have, you know, I try to be in this state of acceptance as much as possible. And I really feel like that's her in so many ways, because, you know, her condition and what she had to live with, the amount of acceptance she must have had to practice or be in order to be in a body that didn't work very well, and with a, you know, brain damaged. I mean, wow. And so, you know, I guess I embodied that a lot. And in terms of, you know, I come back to the idea of cultivating an actual kind of spoken relationship with her, but it's not something I currently do. But it comes to my mind every now and again, and I think, yeah, I want to do that. But I never quite get there. But I also feel like there's just stuff to explore as I go through my life, and, you know, I can come back to it.
It's an unfolding.
Yeah.
I think it's so curious and interesting how for some people their relationship with someone can be improved after death.
Yes.
You know,
that's massive.
We can have a better relationship with some people in our lives after they've passed away. It's interesting, isn't it?
Really. I mean, it's fascinated me. And, you know, in so many ways, I it took me a long time to get over kind of blaming myself for not having a relationship with her while she was alive, or a proper relationship with her. But, you know, I made the choices I made them when I was a tiny boy, when I knew no better. And, you know, I took on some beliefs and ideas that really were, I wasn't to be blamed for them. You know, I did it to protect myself and I did it to feel safe.
It's how you survived the trauma of losing your sister from your family fold.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I can accept that, you know, but I had to look at it first, you know, I had to explore it. I can, you know, because it was just in this massive stuff inside me for so long.
Well, there's such a journey to acceptance. And I think people get acceptance, they misunderstand acceptance. You know, we talk in grief about one of the primary tasks of the griever is to accept the reality of the loss or accept the reality of the death. And knowing that someone has died is very different to accepting it's a reality.
Yeah.
You know, and when we say accepting, we don't mean that we're okay with it. Mm. You know, it just means that this is a truth and every cell in my body knows it,
yeah,
as opposed to just my brain.
I think that's a really key point, actually, the body, the somatic aspect of it, because I feel like acceptance is something you feel. Yeah.
We hear it all the time from bereaved people who, you know, they know somebody has died and then they go to phone them 2 days later.
Right.
And then they have to feel that wave of loss again as they remember, oh no, they're gone. Mm. Or, you know, you think you spot someone in a crowd and then that wave of loss as you realize, no, it couldn't be them.
Mm.
Or there's a shadow in the corner of my eye. Is that them walking through the door? That wave of loss as we remember, sure, no, it's not them again. And I think people we love have to die 1,000 times sometimes before we fully accept with the cells of our body that that they are gone, even though we can know it. We can know it with the brain.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that.
Yeah, well, look, what an amazing story, Alan. And thank you so much for reaching out and sharing it with the listeners today. There's so much in there. There's so much in there. And such a message of hope. What's your next trip? Literal or metaphorical?
Yeah, I guess, you know, my current trip is I have a 10-month-old baby. And there's a lot of time taken up with that, but I don't actually have any physical trips planned, but you know, I guess I'm at the moment, I'm actually, the biggest thing I'm doing is working on my business. So, you know, I teach mindfulness now and I work with people and nature connection, actually. So yeah, I do that, and developing that and embodying that more, actually, is my kind of purpose at the moment. And yeah, and also, you know, talking to people feels like, you know, a really important thing. And I'm so glad that you agreed to have a chat. And that's partly because, you know, I feel like the sort of stuff, like with depression and grief and things like that, it's stuff that we need to talk about. And I think it's especially men, even, you know, and I guess, you know, I would always encourage people to be a little bit brave and take a little chance when we reach that point of feeling scared about talking to someone, because that's all it takes sometimes, isn't it? It's just about taking that little step.
Yeah,
being brave.
And I think just sharing the experiences, like just you saying, I'm a sensitive person, and, you know, it's just so important to normalize all of these experiences, you know. And as a mother of 3 boys, I love this, you know. I'll be having my sons listen, and, you know, you're the kind of person I want them to listen to in the world.
And that's very nice of you to say.
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely.
And I did, you know, it's the same with my book, you know. In some ways, I just had to write it. I kept a journal while I walked, so I kind of felt like, okay, the book's going to come out of that. And I rewrote it so many times, but in the end, it was really that it's the kind of physical representation, in a sense, of that, of my kind of journey to being open. in a way to share that with people, you know. It's not necessarily about like I want to change every people's lives, but it's just I wanted to be open and show that it's okay to be open.
Yeah,
and that's the big thing.
And I'm delighted another baby came along in the mix.
I know, and a boy as well.
Yeah, gorgeous. Alan, will you share with me the links to your work? I'm sure there'll be somebody listening who would love to join you. Do you do classes online at all?
I do, yeah, I do. I teach mindfulness courses regularly. Also, yeah, I do retreats and things, but mainly in the UK. But, you know, I'm open to suggestions or offers. I'm up for, you know, working or talking to anyone really. And but with the book, actually, in Ireland, you can get the book if you're interested from my publisher, Book Hub Publishing. And they're based in Galway. So you can go to bookhubpublishing.com to get the book if you want. But yeah, and my own thing is called Endless River. And my website is endless-river.org. And you can kind of see, you can read about me a bit there and see the stuff I do and whatever, get in touch. You know, I do a bit of Instagram and Facebook and stuff like that as well. So I'm always up for chatting with people without any expectation or, you know, it's just about sharing, isn't it?
Yeah, wonderful. I will share those links in the description of the podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Well done on such an achievement.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
It's a lovely metaphor, actually, just before we end. It's one I use often when I'm supporting people in grief. You know, I tell them about doing the Camino a few years ago with my daughter, and she was only 12 or 13, actually, when we did it. I thought she was huge at the time because she's the eldest of four, but she was a baby. Mm. But I talk about how we started this journey and neither of us were prepared for it. We hadn't been walking or, you know, training or anything. And in the first few days, it just felt like we were given something that was too much to carry, you know. We didn't have the physical muscles for it, and we weren't able to manage these heavy backpacks. And, you know, bit by bit, we started shedding what we didn't need out of the backpacks while simultaneously growing the muscles we needed to be able to carry what was there of the backpack. So it's like this dual process of having to carry something while you're not yet strong enough to carry it, which is such a metaphor for grief. You know, it can feel bigger than us.
Yes.
It can feel bigger than us and it's too much, but somehow we do grow around it enough to be able to carry it. And then, you know, if we continue to face it and express it and explore it and in doing so integrate it, you know, eventually there's more space between us and the grief and around it, so that there's space for other things in our life as well.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, nice metaphor as well.
Yeah, yeah. So well done, and I wish you the luck moving forward as you continue to explore your relationship with Aoife and your grief.
Thank you.
And life, that's what we're all doing really, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a trip.
It sure is. Well, good luck on your trip as I go on mine, and thanks so much, Alan.
You're welcome. Thanks, Liz.
Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from me, Liz Gleeson, take really good care.
On a storm-torn shoreline, a woman was standing. The spray hung like jewels in her hair. Neath the rock of that desolate landing, oh, as though there were none, she stood there.
absolutely gorgeous.